All right. My name is Anne Belahousky. I am an infection control manager at St. Joe's in Hamilton, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Bill Jarvis. He is going to be talking to you today on the top 10 must-dos for the elimination of healthcare-associated infection. This teleclass is sponsored by Gojo, so thank you very much to them for that. Dr. Jarvis, I'm sure for many of you, needs no introduction, but he has been a leader in infection control for over 20 years. He's investigated and published over 150 hospital outbreaks, supervised and was an author on many of the current infection control guidelines, conducted hundreds of epidemiological studies, and trained over 50 EIS officers at the CDC. He spent over 22 years at the CDC in leadership positions in infection control and is considered one of the world's experts in this area. Welcome, Dr. Jarvis.
Thank you very much, Anne, and thank you, everyone, for joining us. As Anne mentioned, we're going to talk about the top 10 must-dos for the elimination of healthcare-associated infections. Next slide. I define the to-dos based upon both the scientific evidence and what I would like you to do if I were in your hospital. I consult for a number of companies and organizations, none of whom had any influence on today's presentation. Next slide. If we look at the numbers from the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, on the estimated annual number and cost and mortality associated with healthcare-associated infections, as all of you know, these infections fall into four main groups: surgical site infections, central line-associated bloodstream infections, ventilator-associated pneumonia, and catheter-associated UTIs. They account for a large number of infections, huge costs, and a large number of deaths each year. Next slide. The first to do, I would say, is surveillance. Conducting active, prospective surveillance for healthcare-associated infections. Next slide. Without measurement, which is what surveillance is, one does not know what your HAI rate is or if prevention or control measures are effective. On the other hand, if you're going to do surveillance, you must do it using standardized methods. Calculated standardized incidence rates, such as central line-associated bloodstream infections, etc., using standardized definitions, standardized surveillance protocols, appropriate risk adjustment, and using the appropriate denominator for rate calculation. This is the basics of our infection control programs. The model, next slide, that most of us are familiar with are the CDC's National Healthcare Safety Network. Next slide. I think this is a good role model or starting point. You'll note they have a number of different components: patient safety, healthcare personnel safety, being the two major surveillance activities that we conduct. Next slide. In the patient safety component, the device-associated infections, whether it be central line, ventilator-associated pneumonia, catheter-associated UTIs, are the largest category of surveillance that we do, device-related infections. And we know, particularly in intensive care units, but even outside of intensive care units, the majority of healthcare-associated infections are associated with devices. The second factor are procedures, as you see here with surgical site infections, and then further down, multi-drug-resistant organisms, or MDROs, or C. difficile. The organisms that we know account for great morbidity and mortality. Next slide. I show you this table because I want to make a point about benchmarking. This is a table from NHSN data on central line-associated bloodstream infection rates. You can see the various types of ICUs, number of locations, the number of infections and central line days, and then pooled means. But think about this. Compare your ICU to mine. Do you know what kind of patients I have in my ICU? Do you know what type of catheters I use? Do I use single lumen, double lumen, triple lumen? Do I prefer IJ lines? Do I prefer PICCs? Do I prefer peripheral IVs? Non-central lines. Are they single lumen, double lumen? mostly surgical patients, medical patients, what are their underlying diseases? You don't know any of those things. So rather than benchmarking and comparing yourself either to a national average or to any other average other than your own, you should be comparing your rate to yourself over time, because you know which of those many factors and others that influence central line associated bloodstream infections have changed, with your goal being to get to zero. Next slide. The second to-do is prevention of central line associated bloodstream infections. We've all heard of insertion bundles, only inserting catheters when they're necessary, using a catheter insertion checklist to monitor all the processes, to perform hand hygiene before catheter insertion, to use a catheter insertion and a dressing change kit or cart so that all the materials that are needed by the clinician are there and they don't need to think about it, know what it is, or go find it. Use of at least 0.5% chlorhexidine with alcohol for skin antisepsis. Use of maximum bare precaution, so treating the insertion of a catheter as if it's a surgical procedure. So cap, mask, gown, gloves, full body drape. Vessel preservation, picking the right catheter, inserting it at the right site. In particular, avoiding the femoral line. But in addition to avoiding the femoral line is thinking about what this patient needs this catheter for, what's going to go through that catheter, and how long is it going to go through that catheter. So you're not putting a triple lumen central venous catheter in every single patient. And then remove the catheters as soon as possible. This insertion bundle should be done for every insertion of every central line. Next slide. A lot of attention has been placed on insertion bundles and less attention on maintenance. But if you look at the pathophysiology of how these infections occur, you need both. The insertion bundle attacks the prevention of infection or contamination occurring at the time of catheter insertion. So organisms on the skin that might be picked up by that catheter. In contrast, maintenance issues include both the skin microorganisms and the manipulation of that catheter. So you should be using the safest needleless connector. You should be scrubbing the hub of that connector with chlorhexidine or alcohol for at least 15 seconds with each manipulation. Use of the chlorhexidine impregnated sponge or biopatch to keep the bacterial load at that insertion site as low as it was when you first applied the chlorhexidine. Daily chlorhexidine bathing has been recommended, I would say, for medical ICUs. The data show primarily an impact on medical ICUs, primarily an impact on vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. There are mixed data on surgical intensive care units, and only one study has looked at application of chlorhexidine bathing outside of ICUs. And that paper had to add MRSA and VRE in order to reach statistical significance. Use antiseptic or antimicrobial impregnated catheters if the catheter is in place for more than 5 days. Maintain lumen patency, because we know partial or total occlusions can lead to infection. Keep the dressing dry and intact. Remove those lines when they're no longer medically needed, and use antimicrobial or antiseptic locks. The latter, antimicrobial or antiseptic locks, or even prophylactic antimicrobials, have been particularly effective in hemodialysis patients, where there's over 12 randomized controlled trials showing that prophylactic antibiotics used to prevent infection in hemodialysis patients is effective. What's the impact of these interventions? Next slide. Well, the first attempt at applying an insertion bundle and some elements of the maintenance bundle was by Bernholtz and Pronovost at the Surgical Intensive Care Unit, Johns Hopkins University. And you can see here different interventions, line card, daily goals, checklist, empowering nurses to stop the procedure if it wasn't done correctly. And what you see is that the median rate decreased from about 11 to 12 central line associated bloodstream infections per 1,000 catheter days two on the far right, zero. Now, do they maintain zero every single month in this ICU? No. But they have many more months with zero than they did before this intervention. Pronovost then took this intervention, next slide, and implemented what's called the Keystone Project, which was a large interventional cohort study in 108 different Michigan intensive care units over 18 months, where they primarily focused on the insertion bundle. But many of the hospitals were using elements of the maintenance bundle, they just didn't collect the data on that. The results published in the New England Journal were from 103 ICUs, almost 2,000 months of data, and almost 376,000 catheter days. The median rate started at 2.7 per 1,000 catheter days, which is, at that time, lower than the NHSN median. But look, by 3 months, they were at zero. I think partially because it was only insertion and not a maintenance bundle totally used. By 16 to 18 months, it bounced back a little bit to 1.4 per 1,000 catheter days, but that's still a 66% reduction in the BSI rate at 103 ICUs. So I think the data are compelling that this use of insertion and maintenance bundles, and there have now been several publications showing that if you're using an insertion bundle, that you start seeing infections that occur later that are associated with maintenance, and therefore you need a maintenance bundle as well. That the implementation of insertion and maintenance bundles should be mandated for all of our ICU patients, and studies now should be assessing it outside of ICUs where there's no reason to believe, since the pathophysiology of these infections is the same, that it wouldn't have the same impact. Next slide. We can see a number of examples. In addition to the Pronovost intervention in Michigan, we have the intervention in the hospitals in Pennsylvania showing a significant decrease between April of 2001 and April of 2005 in their ICUs, of decrease both in medical surgical and all ICU BSI rate. Next slide. In addition, we have data from the entire collaborative of New York City hospitals showing a decrease in BSI rate from 4.5 to 5 per 1,000 catheter days down to about 1.5 per 1,000 catheter days over a two-year time period. This is 46 different hospitals. Next slide. Last, even if we look at site-specific, and this is a little bit complicated because it's also confounded by the increasing implementation of active surveillance testing, but we see on this slide national data showing that the second most common pathogen, with coagulase negative staphylococci being number one, MRSA being number two, that there has been a significant decrease in MRSA BSIs in the different types of intensive care units in the CDC's NHSN system between 1997 and 2007. Due, I think, because of both implementation of bundles and active surveillance testing. And then last, next slide. If we look at the CDC has published data in late in 2011 where they looked at BSI rates in their surveillance system in intensive care units in 2001, where there were about 43,000 infections. By 2009, that number had dropped to 18,000 infections. Significant decrease in central line-associated bloodstream infections. In fact, if you look at inpatient units in 2009, inpatient wards had higher rates of BSI, 23,000, than intensive care units. Another reason why we need to be pushing these interventions outside of intensive care units to be hospital-wide. And then last, if you look at the bottom line there of outpatient hemodialysis centers, they had the highest rate of BSI now, 37,000. So there's significant opportunities for improvement, both in inpatient wards and in outpatient hemodialysis units by implementing these same groups of bundles and in hemodialysis patients, additional interventions, such as I mentioned with prophylactic antibiotic. Next slide. The fourth to-do is prevention of surgical site infections. First is to administer the prophylactic antibiotic within 30 to 60 minutes not 0 to 30, before the surgical incision. I know in the United States, CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Service, gives you credit if you've given the antibiotic within 1 hour, 0 to 60 minutes of the incision. Does that make sense to you? If you give the antibiotic 5 minutes before the incision, what's the likelihood you have peak level in your blood at the, or in the tissues at the time of that incision? In fact, the median time from giving a first-generation cephalosporin to having a peak in the bone of the mediastinum is 22 minutes. In fact, talking to Dr. Burke, who is one of the authors of the study that led to this recommendation, he pointed out that really if you looked at 0 to 30 versus 30 to 60, the 30 to 60 had the lowest rate of infection. And we should be giving antibiotics from 30 to 60 minutes before the incision, except for vancomycin. Second is to administer the correct prophylactic antibiotic for the surgical procedure, but also to increase the dose in obese patients. If you give the same 1 gram of first-generation cephalosporin to a patient who has a BMI over 20, you're underdosing that patient. And then redose for procedures greater than 3 hours. Discontinue the prophylactic antibiotic within 24 hours after surgery end time, except for cardiac surgery where it can be 48 hours. Maintain appropriate perioperative glucose control, particularly in cardiac surgery patients where this has been shown to decrease infection. Do not shave hair, clip if necessary. Maintain appropriate perioperative temperature management, that is normothermia, particularly during colon surgery. Minimize the number and movement of operating room personnel. When I observe operative procedures, many hospitals treat the operating room as if it's a bar. People coming and going, two or three or four anesthesiologists in the room during a single procedure, bringing briefcases, iPads, iPhones, telephones, etc., into the operating room with them. This is inappropriate. Ensure appropriate skin antisepsis. This is particularly true if you're using povidone iodine. Go watch what happens in your operating room. The technicians apply the povidone iodine, and then they immediately turn around and get those little green towels and place them over the skin and soak up all that povidone iodine. Well, how does povidone iodine work? It works by releasing free iodine. And how does it do that? It does that by drying. So if you're applying the povidone iodine and immediately wiping it off, it's not drying, it's not releasing free iodine, it's not having its antiseptic impact. Then last, screen patients for either Staph aureus, both MRSA and MSSA, or just MRSA, depending upon which is the most problematic pathogen for you. And then for elective procedures, decolonize that patient. We know from studies that the primary source for both MRSA, MSSA, and coagulase negative staphylococci causing surgical site infections are the patient's own flora. So if you eliminate that, you dramatically reduce their risk of infection. Next slide. This is a figure from a study done as a part of the Surgical Infection Prevention Project of CMS. And they wanted to look at how often was the right antibiotic given, how often was it given within 1 hour, how often was it discontinued within 24 hours. And as you can see, 91% of the time the right antibiotic was given. 65% of the time the antibiotic was given within 1 hour. I already told you that that's fudging, going 0 to 60 rather than 30 to 60. And then discontinuing the antibiotic at 24 hours was 42%. The problem is we don't want one of these done correctly. We want all three of them done correctly. And at the top there, you see all three done correctly was 28% of the time. Not exactly a good batting average. So we have dramatic room for improvement on a very simple thing of applying surgical prophylactic antibiotics at the right time. Next slide. The fifth to do is preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infections using the bladder bundle. First, insert urinary catheters only for appropriate indications. If you look at the CDC guideline or other guidelines, including the Shea Compendium, they give a consensus of experts of what appropriate indications are. leave catheters in place only as long as they're needed. They should not be left in for nursing or physician convenience. Ensure that only properly trained persons insert and maintain catheters. Insert catheters using aseptic technique and sterile equipment. Maintain a closed drainage system. Maintain unobstructed urine flow. Use antimicrobial or antiseptic impregnated catheters. Consider physician reminders and automatic stop orders, because study by Sanjay Saint and others have shown that oftentimes the physician doesn't remember that the patient has a urinary catheter, and oftentimes, particularly post-surgical patients, the catheter is placed in the operating room, the surgeon doesn't pay attention, and the catheter remains in place when, if you have an automatic stop, they have to override that and give a justification for why it needs to stay in place. Consider alternatives to indwelling urinary catheterization. And then use portable ultrasound devices to assess urine volume to reduce unnecessary catheterizations. Next slide. Number six to do is prevention of ventilator-associated pneumonia. Number one is avoid endotracheal intubation, if possible. If you do that, the patient has no risk. Similarly with catheters for urinary catheters or intravascular catheters, if you don't put the device in, you're not going to have the infection. If you must intubate, use oral rather than nasal endotracheal intubation. Do hand hygiene before and after patient contact. All patients should be assessed daily for weaning and extubation. Minimize the duration and intensity of sedation and device exposure. Avoid the supine position. Aim for at least a 30% angle for the head up. Use chlorhexidine for daily mouth care. Use subglottic secretion drainage in patients likely to be ventilated for more than 48 hours. Avoid non-essential tracheal suction. Use sterile water for irrigation. Minimize the duration of mechanical ventilation and promote tracheostomy when ventilation is needed for a longer period of time. Next slide. We have evidence from a number of sources, but this happens to be from Scotland, where they implemented a ventilator-associated pneumonia prevention bundle. And as you can see in red, that's the ventilator-associated pneumonia rate per 1,000 ventilator days. They went from around 10 to even as high as over 20 ventilator-associated pneumonias per 1,000 ventilator days to, on the far right, 6 months, where they had zero in a row. What you can see in black is compliance with the bundle. And as compliance with the bundle approaches 90 to 100%, ventilator-associated pneumonias disappeared. Next slide. This is an example, again, from Scotland, a number of different hospitals, and you can see that for a wide range of hospitals, the ventilator-associated pneumonia rate decreased through use of a ventilator-associated pneumonia bundle. Next slide. The number seven to do, the importance of environmental cleaning and decontamination. Educate environmental services personnel about their critical role in healthcare-associated infection, HAI, prevention. Educate environmental services personnel about recommended cleaning practices and the importance of following hospital cleaning practices. Important is to develop policies on which patient care equipment and environmental services are to be cleaned by either environmental services personnel or by nursing personnel, because there's often equipment, particularly in ICUs, that environmental services personnel are very hesitant to touch because they're fearful of what might happen if they do. As a result, nursing personnel often decontaminate that equipment, but they need to know that they're supposed to and how they're supposed to do it. Ensure compliance by environmental services personnel with cleaning and disinfection procedures. So using a checklist, using monitoring, there's been a number of different ways to monitor the efficacy of cleaning Certainly one of those is to use a fluorescent dye, such as GloGerm. If you're going to use that, you need to make sure you change what surfaces you place that on, because environmental services personnel learn where those places are you're putting it, and will clean only those places. And then consider enhanced methods for terminal cleaning of rooms. We've seen now increasing data on both ultraviolet irradiation and use of hydrogen peroxide gas or vapor for terminal cleaning of rooms, showing its efficacy with a wide variety of pathogens. Next slide. The number eight to do is hand hygiene. I put at the top of the list system change, because I think this is really a systems problem. We need the CEOs and directors, nursing and physician directors of units, to be held accountable for what happens in those units. We need to educate healthcare workers about when they're supposed to do hand hygiene. Obviously, use of alcohol-based hand rubs, gels, or foams are the most effective, easiest to use, friendliest to our hands, saves tremendous time. Need to make sure we have proper dispenser placement. Rather than having it in the hallway, don't you want it right next to the bed? Don't you want it so that clinicians will use that product right before they touch the patient or touch their invasive device, rather than in the hallway so they can go and touch a computer monitor, touch a wide variety of inanimate environmental surfaces before they touch that patient? Monitoring and feedback performance. I know many of you, most of you, are doing visual monitoring of hand hygiene compliance. Well, I would recommend that you see an article Mark Farber and colleagues published in Clinical Infectious Diseases several months ago. In his intensive care unit, the baseline visual monitoring compliance with hand hygiene was measured to be about 60%. So, as good or better than probably most facilities. They then put in video cameras. Those video cameras only measured going into the room and coming out of the room. So they didn't measure hand hygiene compliance, which is most important when you're touching that patient or their invasive device. But guess what compliance with hand hygiene was going in and coming out of the room? When measured by video camera and trained personnel reviewing the videotapes, 10%. And I don't think that's unusual. With visual monitoring, number one, you have the Hawthorne effect because they know you're there. Number two, you can only watch usually one room at a time. Most of the time you do that visual observation between 9 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when we know hand hygiene compliance at night and weekends is worse. And oftentimes it's very difficult to see the most important part, which is the hand hygiene that's done at the time of contact with the patient or their invasive device. My personal belief is that video or electronic monitoring is the only unbiased, effective way to do hand hygiene compliance assessment, and that we will be moving toward that. You need administrative support. You need managers, administrators, unit leaders to enforce the recommendations. Infection prevention should do the monitoring, but they should not be doing the policing. The managers, the administrators, the unit leaders should be doing the enforcing. And then, as I mentioned, you need leadership and culture change. The CEO of the hospital, if they really believe that patient safety is important, should want to know who is not doing hand hygiene, and then address those individuals. Next slide. We know from CDC and World Health Organization the 5 minutes of hand hygiene before touching a patient, before cleaning or aseptic procedure, after body fluid exposure, after touching the patient, and after touching the patient's surroundings. the two most important are before touching the patient or before a clean or aseptic procedure, and yet those are the most difficult to do adequate monitoring of. Next slide. We need to also educate our healthcare personnel of how to do hand hygiene. Doing it right is important. And there are guidance from the World Health Organization as well as CDC as shown on this slide. Importantly, an appropriate amount of hand hygiene agent and then applying that to all surfaces of the hands for adequate length of time is critical. Next slide. As you can see on this slide, the most frequently missed area are the thumbs and the tips of the fingers. And what are the places of the hands that most commonly contact our patients and their devices? Those locations. So the places on the hands that we do hand hygiene the worst on are the ones that are most likely to have contact with our patients and their devices. Next slide. Antimicrobial stewardship. This could be a teleclass all on its own. I don't have time to go through all of these 12 different interventions that have been recommended by the CDC. But I think it also shows by the fact that there's so many different things to do that oftentimes, if not most of the time, we really don't know what we're doing in terms of antimicrobial stewardship. My personal belief is that if you don't have a physician or a PharmD full-time doing this, that you're probably not doing a particularly good job. And secondly, that it needs to be bug-drug driven. We know the antibiotics that drive resistance among enterococci, for instance, particularly vancomycin that's used for MRSA. So if you prevent MRSA, you're probably going to prevent VRE. We know that antimicrobial use leads to C. difficile. So looking at your hospital and assessing what are the pathogens, particularly resistant pathogens, that are most problematic at your hospital can help you then develop a game plan on attacking those specific pathogens and the antibiotics that drive those pathogens. Dr. John Burke wrote an excellent editorial a number of years ago, called it something like pushing a balloon in, and we see that if you push in one area or you stop using one antibiotic or class of antibiotics, oftentimes up pops resistance associated with the different antibiotics. So maintaining surveillance so you know what the problematic pathogens are, looking at secular trends, and then attacking them by both infection control interventions and antimicrobial use interventions, as well as making sure you prevent infections and diagnose and treat them effectively, can go a long way toward improving your antimicrobial stewardship program. Number 10. Next slide. If we look at all antibiotic-resistant pathogens, literally everywhere in the world, in the majority of those places, the number one antibiotic-resistant pathogen is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. I think we're starting to see here in the United States and in North America a reversal of the continued increase in MRSA as a healthcare-associated infection. And obviously, some interventions in the UK have shown great success as well. The core elements that have led to that are, one, doing a risk assessment to identify high-risk patients. Second, doing active surveillance testing of identified high-risk patients or of all patients to identify the reservoir for spread. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, there's at least four studies that show that if you look at detecting MRSA through clinical cultures, that you're going to detect at most 35% of the patients who have MRSA, because the majority of patients that have MRSA, just like with VRE or ESBL-producing gram-negatives or carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, are colonized. And there's no way for you to know who is colonized without testing them. And certainly for MRSA and VRE, studies have shown that colonized patients contaminate their environment and lead to transmission just as easily and equally to that of infected patients. Then placing these colonized or infected patients in bearer precautions, usually contact isolation, doing hand hygiene before going into those rooms, and then it should be in smaller letters, decolonization or suppression of colonized patients. I would limit this to outbreak situations and surgical patients. We have very good data now that for cardiac, orthopedic, neurosurgical, basically implant surgical procedures, that detecting MRSA or even Staph aureus in general, MSSA and MRSA, and decolonizing those individuals before they have their elective procedures will reduce their risk of infection. There's much less evidence that widespread decolonization using usually mupirocin intranasally and chlorhexidine baths as a general control measure for MRSA on the ward or in the ICU under an endemic situation is essential. And it certainly raises the risk of increasing resistance to either one of those agents. And then last, antibiotic stewardship. There are very little data that monitoring or reducing antibiotics of any sort have an impact on MRSA. There's virtually three or four studies, 75% of them were in surgical patients, and they had a short-term impact. Long-term didn't have any impact. So let's look, what's the impact if you do these things? Next slide. Well, probably the best study to date is by Jan and colleagues from the Veterans Administration system, where they began an intervention in an intensive care unit using what I'll call that last bundle of active detection of isolation. So screening of patients for MRSA, placing them in contact isolation, hand hygiene, a little bit of impact on our influence in terms of environmental cleaning, and then, quote, culture change. And as you can see here in orange, their MRSA rate decreased in their intensive care units from in the range of 1.5 per 1,000 patient days down to about 0.6 per 1,000 patient days. So about a 70% decrease in MRSA. Similarly, in the non-ICUs, as you can see here in blue, decreased from about 0.6 down to about 0.3. Both are statistically significant decreases. The thing I like about this study was this is a real-life study. This was literally 150 hospitals across the United States and went from 2005 to 2010. We're talking about 5 years. This was not a six-month or three-month intervention. The retrospective period was 2005 to about 2007, so about 2 years' worth of data, and then an intervention period where the different elements were brought in, and then from October 2007 to June of 2010, so almost 3 years of intervention data. Very impressive. Next slide. If we look at their healthcare-associated infection rate, whether we're looking at pneumonia, bloodstream infections, urinary tract infections, skin or soft tissue infections, it didn't make any difference. All of them, when caused by MRSA, were significantly decreased. If we look specifically at the rate of ventilator-associated pneumonia and central line-associated infections on the next slide, you can see in orange are the rates of ventilator-associated pneumonia, which were up in the about 1.5 to almost 2 per 1,000 ventilator days and decreased to the range of almost 0 to maybe 0.6. So at least a two-thirds and maybe even greater decrease. Central line-associated bloodstream infections were in the 0.6 to 0.8 range and decreased down, as you see, in December 2008 to 0, December 2009, 0, and then very low rates. More importantly, if you look at statistical significance, both the decrease in ventilator-associated pneumonia and central line-associated bloodstream infections caused by MRSA, when compared to the baseline or retrospective data, significantly decreased. Now, in this study, they did universal testing. They tested everybody that came into the ICU and ultimately then expanded it to everyone that came into the hospital. They also used polymerase chain reaction so they get their result much quicker. They did not use decolonization. In contrast, next slide, a study by Peterson and Robichek up in Evanston, Illinois, where they did an intervention somewhat similar to the VA, and actually before the VA. But in this case, they use universal testing. They use PCR for that testing. And then they also implemented mupirocin intranasally and chlorhexidine bathing for decolonization. The prevalence density of MRSA infection at each body site decreased. The percentage of exogenous MRSA fell from 48% to 33%. The intervention was estimated to reduce healthcare-associated infection costs by almost $9 million and prevented 72 deaths. And as you can see from the figure, there was a significant decrease in MRSA after this intervention was implemented. Next slide. We have data from our APIC prevalence survey recently published in AJIC showing that there's been a dramatic increase in the proportion of hospitals doing active surveillance testing. And I think that's a partial explanation, next slide, for the results from CDC published in JAMA in 2010, showing that for the first time here in the United States, when we compare 2005 to 2008, we're starting to see a reduction in MRSA. Now, this is looking only at invasive MRSA, which is primarily, if you look at the study, bloodstream infections. But there was a yearly decrease of about almost 10%, 9.4%, of hospital onset and of healthcare-associated community onset, about 6% decrease annually. Both of those were statistically significant. That's all MRSA infections. If you look specifically at bloodstream infections, hospital onset decreased by about 11%, and healthcare-associated community onset decreased, again, by about 6.5%. So we are, for the first time, seeing a reversal of a trend that has gone on since 1980 in the United States. So over 30 years of increasing rates every single year, now we're starting to see a reduction. And the major thing that has changed has been the implementation of active surveillance testing, as well as the various bundles. Next slide. I think one of the things that is also changing is the culture, that we are moving to a culture of zero tolerance for healthcare-associated infections. Does that mean that everybody's going to get to zero? No, unless we define our out of them, no, that's not going to happen. But I think we see a number of hospitals throughout the country in the United States that have implemented these bundles and are witnessing a dramatic decrease in their healthcare-associated infection rate. For the first time, I think made it clear to certainly many intensivists, but also many of us in infection control, that zero is a realistic goal. Here you see ventilator-associated pneumonia quarterly data from Mercy Hospital's ICU, where they significantly decrease and have many, many, many months with zero. On the right-hand side is a Connecticut ICU, where, again, the rate has gone to zero and is much lower than the CDC's National Healthcare Safety Network median rate. Next slide. We talked about the CLABSI intervention in the surgical intensive care unit, but in fact, at Johns Hopkins, that was implemented in all the different ICUs. And you can see it doesn't matter if it's CCU, cardiac surgery ICU, medical, neurologic, surgical, any of the ICUs, all of them had a decrease in their BSI rate. And several of them either achieved or became very close to zero. The bottom of the slide is Allegheny General Hospital's cardiac ICU coronary care unit, where you can see the BSI rate was in the range of some 4 to 8 per 1,000 catheter days. And at the bottom, you see many, 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 many months where their rate is zero. Next slide. Mainline Health System out of Philadelphia. The top is catheter-associated UTIs. You see a lot of zeros there. Bottom is ventilator-associated pneumonia. Again, you see a lot of zeros. And on the right-hand side, the monthly central line-associated bloodstream infection rate. Again, a lot of zeros. So I think these data show us that we can achieve zero. On the last slide are data from Sophie Harnage out of Sutter Roseville Hospital, where she has implemented basically an insertion and maintenance bundle. The only difference is she's added an IV team to that as well, and she's looked at their PIC lines and their BSIs associated with PIC lines, and as you can see on the slide at the left, after implementation of this intervention, they have now gone almost, I believe, 4 years without a single central line-associated bloodstream infection associated with PICs in that hospital. Quite an achievement and quite an improvement in patient safety. If you look at all CVCs hospital-wide and see between 2006 and 2009, it was one infection. Next slide. So in conclusion, by implementing these evidence-based interventions, a large proportion of HAIs can be prevented. Bundles of interventions, rather than just one, have been shown to be effective in reducing HAIs. We're entering a new era. The old era was one of acceptability. Oh, our patients are so sick, they have all these invasive devices, these infections are just inevitable, to a new era of what I call zero tolerance for HAIs, where we know if we implement these bundles, the majority of these infections can and will be prevented, and that then we can do a root cause analysis on any infections that do occur to identify what went wrong. And that's where the checklists are particularly useful. Rather than going back and asking the clinician, when did you insert that urinary catheter or central venous catheter, and what did you do at that time, where you hope that they can remember, and most of them will not be able to remember and will tell you what they think they should have done rather than what they did, you can pull out that checklist that was completed the time they did it and see whether they did all the things they should have done. If they complied with the bundle, then perhaps your bundle doesn't have all the elements that it needs, or this was an infection that really wasn't preventable. On the other hand, if they didn't do all the things they should have done, it's an opportunity to educate them. And I think in this new era of zero tolerance, we'll all be striving to achieve zero infection rates. All infections are not preventable, but certainly these data show that the majority of them are. And last, infection control is everybody's business. Infection control should be leading the way, should be educating, but a lot of the enforcement should be done by either the C-suite or the nursing or physician directors of those units. And we need to hold clinicians accountable for what they do. Last, the key elements for the elimination of healthcare-associated infections include collecting the data, surveillance, and disseminating those results. Should have full adherence to evidence-based best practices, recognize excellence, and I would say celebrate successes. That when you achieve that zero in that ICU for CLA, BSIs, or ventilator-associated pneumonia, celebrate it. Be proud of it. Identify and respond to emerging threats, and improve science for prevention through research. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jarvis, for a very informative teleclass. I'm sure that everyone who is listening will have elements that will speak to them in their areas if they have issues that they're dealing with, and you've given them some very, very good information to take away. I'd also like to thank Gojo for sponsoring this session. At that point, we will close the session. Thank you to everyone who has taken the time to join us, and thank you again, Dr. Jarvis, for a very informative session, and to Gojo for sponsoring.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.